Those were the younger faces. The older ones, they just started running. They had a different kind of survival instinct. An instinct born in a time when they were slaves in their own country. In those days, everyone knew who they were. And if they were ever coming, all you could do was run and pray.
Did you run?
I couldn't. My family, my mother and two little sisters, lived only a few doors down from the Radio Zibonele station, exactly where the mob was fleeing from. I wasn't thinking. I was stupid. I should have doubled back around, found an alley or quiet street. I tried to wade through the mob, pushing in the opposite direction. I thought I could stay along the sides of the shanties. I was knocked into one of their plastic walls that wrapped around me as the whole structure collapsed. I was trapped. I couldn't breathe. Someone ran over me, smashed my head into the ground. I shook myself free, wriggled and rolled out into the street. I was still on my stomach when I saw them, 10 or 15, silhouetted against the fires of the burning shanties. I couldn't see their faces, but I could hear them moaning. They were slouching steadily toward me with their arms raised. I got to my feet. My head swam. My body ached all over. Instinctively, I began to withdraw, backing into the doorway of the closest shack. Something grabbed me from behind, pulled at my collar, tore the fabric. I spun, ducked, and kicked hard. He was large, larger and heavier than me by a few kilos. Black fluid ran down the front of his white shirt. A knife protruded from his chest, jammed between the ribs and buried to the hilt. A scrap of my collar, which was clenched between his teeth, dropped as his lower jaw fell open. He growled. He lunged. I tried to dodge. He grabbed my wrist. I felt a crack, and pain shot up through my body. I dropped to my knees, tried to roll and maybe trip him up. My hand came up against a heavy cooking pot. I grabbed it and swung hard. It smashed into his face. I hit him again and again, bashing his skull until the bones split open and the brain spilled out across my feet. He slumped over. I freed myself, just as another one of them appeared in the entrance. This time, the structure's flimsy nature worked to my advantage. I kicked the back wall open, slinking out and bringing the whole hut down in the process. I ran. I didn't know where I was going. It was a nightmare of shacks and fire and grasping hands all racing past me. I ran through a shanty where a woman was hiding in the corner. Her two children were huddled against her, crying. "Come with me," I said. "Please, come, we have to go." I held out my hands, moved closer to her. She pulled her children back, brandishing a sharpened screwdriver. Her eyes were wide, scared. I could hear sounds behind me, smashing through shanties, knocking them over as they came. I switched from Xhosa to English. "Please," I begged. "You have to run." I reached for her, but she stabbed my hand. I left her there. I didn't know what else to do. She is still in my memory. When I sleep or maybe close my eyes sometimes. Sometimes she's my mother, and the crying children are my sisters. I saw a bright light up ahead, shining between the cracks in the shanties. I ran as hard as I could. I tried to call to them. I was out of breath. I crashed through the wall of a shack, and suddenly I was in open ground. The headlights were blinding. I felt something slam into my shoulder. I think I was out before I even hit the ground. I came to in a bed at Groot Schuur Hospital. I'd never seen the inside of a recovery ward like this. It was so clean and white. I thought I might be dead. The medication, I'm sure, helped that feeling. I'd never tried any kind of drugs before. Never even touched a drink of alcohol. I didn't want to end up like so many in my neighborhood, like my father. All my life, I'd fought to stay clean. And now, the morphine or whatever they had pumped into my veins was delicious. I didn't care about anything. I didn't care when they told me the police had shot me in the shoulder. I saw the man in the bed next to me, frantically wheeled out as soon as his breathing stopped. I didn't even care when I overheard them talking about the outbreak of rabies.
Who was talking about it?
I don't know. Like I said, I was as high as the stars. I just remember voices in the hallway outside my ward, loud voices, angrily, arguing. That wasn't rabies, one of them yelled. Rabies doesn't do that to people. Then something else, then... Well, what the hell do you suggest? We've got 15 downstairs right here. Who knows how many more are still out there? It's funny. I go over that conversation all the time in my head. What I should have thought, felt, done. It was a long time before I sobered up again. Before I woke up and faced the nightmare.
Tel Aviv, Israel. Jürgen Warmbrunn has a passion for Ethiopian food, which is our reason for meeting at a falasha restaurant. With his bright pink skin and white, unruly eyebrows that match his Einstein hair, he might be mistaken for a crazed scientist or college professor. He is neither. Although never acknowledging which Israeli intelligence service he was, and possibly still is, employed by, he openly admits that at one point he could be called a spy.
Most people don't believe something can happen until it already has. That's not stupidity or weakness. That's just human nature. I don't blame anyone for not believing. I don't claim to be any smarter or better than them. I guess what it really comes down to is the randomness of birth. I happen to be born into a group of people who live in constant fear of extinction. It's part of our identity, part of our mindset, and it has taught us through horrific trial and error to always be on our guard. The first warning I had of the plague was from our friends and customers over in Taiwan. They were complaining about our new software decryption program. Apparently it was failing to decode some emails from PRC sources, or at least decoding them so poorly that the text was unintelligible. I suspected the problem might not be in the software, but in the translated messages themselves. The mainland Reds, I guess they weren't really Reds anymore, but what do you want from an old man? The Reds had a nasty habit of using too many different computers from too many different generations and countries. Before I suggested this theory to Taipei, I thought it might be a good idea to review the scrambled messages myself. I was surprised to find the characters themselves were perfectly decoded, but the text itself, it all had to do with a new viral outbreak that first eliminated its victim, then reanimated his corpse into some kind of homicidal berserker. Of course, I didn't believe this was true. Especially because only a few weeks later, the crisis in the Taiwan Strait began, and any messages dealing with rampaging corpses abruptly ended. I suspected a second layer of encryption, a code within a code. That was pretty standard procedure, going back to the first days of human communication. Of course, the Reds didn't mean actual dead bodies. It had to be a new weapon system or ultra-secret war plan. I let the matter drop, tried to forget about it. Still, As one of your great national heroes used to say, my spider sense was tingling. Not long afterward, at the reception for my daughter's wedding, I found myself speaking to one of my son-in-law's professors from Hebrew University. The man was a talker, and he had a little too much to drink. He was rambling about how his cousin was doing some kind of work in South Africa, and had told him some stories about golems. You know about the golem, the old legend about a rabbi who breathes life into an inanimate statue? Mary Shelley stole the idea for her book Frankenstein. I didn't say anything at first, just listened. The man went on blathering about how these golems weren't made from clay, nor were they docile and obedient. As soon as he mentioned reanimating human bodies, I asked for the man's number. It turns out he had been in Cape Town on one of those adrenaline tours. Shark feeding, I think it was.
He rolls his eyes.
Apparently the shark had obliged him, right in the tuchus, which is why he had been recovering at Rutschur when the first victims of Khayelitsha Township were brought in. He hadn't seen any of these cases firsthand, but the staff had told him enough stories to fill my old dictaphone. I then presented his stories along with those decrypted Chinese emails to my superiors. And this is where I directly benefited from the unique circumstances of our precarious security. In October of 1973, when the Arab sneak attack almost drove us into the Mediterranean, we had all the intelligence in front of us, all the warning signs, and we had simply dropped the ball. We had never considered the possibility of an all-out, coordinated, conventional assault from several nations, certainly not on our holiest of holidays. From 1973 onward, if 9 intelligence analysts came to the same conclusion, it was the duty of the 10th to disagree. No matter how unlikely or far-fetched a possibility might be, one must always dig deeper. If a neighbor's nuclear power plant might be used to make weapons-grade plutonium, you dig. If a dictator was rumored to be building a cannon so big it could fire anthrax shells across whole countries, you dig. And if there was even the slightest chance that dead bodies were being reanimated as ravenous killing machines, you dig and dig until you struck the absolute truth. And that is what I did. I dug. At first it wasn't easy. With China out of the picture, the Taiwan crisis put an end to any intelligence gathering, I was left with very few sources of information. A lot of it was chaff, especially on the Internet. Zombies from space and Area 51. What is your country's fetish for Area 51 anyway? After a while, I started to uncover more useful data. Cases of rabies similar to Cape Town. It wasn't called African rabies until later. I uncovered the psychological evaluations of some Canadian mountain troops recently returned from Kyrgyzstan. I found the blog records of a Brazilian nurse who told her friends all about the murder of a heart surgeon. The majority of my information came from the World Health Organization. The UN is a bureaucratic masterpiece. So many nuggets of valuable data buried in mountains of unread reports. I found incidents all over the world, all of them dismissed with plausible explanations. These cases allowed me to piece together a cohesive mosaic of this new threat. The subjects in question were indeed dead. They were hostile, and they were undeniably spreading. Given their global nature, I thought it might be prudent to seek confirmation from foreign intelligence circles. Paul Knight had been a friend of mine for a long time, going all the way back to Entebbe. The idea to use a double of Amin's black Mercedes, that was him. Paul had retired from government service right before his agency's reforms and gone to work for a private consulting firm in Bethesda, Maryland. When I visited him at his home, I was shocked to find that not only had he been working on the very same project on his own time, of course, but that his file was almost as thick and heavy as mine. We sat up the whole night reading each other's findings. Neither of us spoke. I don't think we were even conscious of each other, the world around us, anything except the words before our eyes. We finished almost at the same time, just as the sky began to lighten in the east. Paul turned the last page, then looked to me and said very matter-of-factly, "This is pretty bad, huh?" I nodded, so did he, and then followed up with, "So, what are we going to do about it?"
And that is how the Wormbrun Night Report was written.
I wish people would stop calling it that. There were 15 other names on that report. Virologists, intelligence operatives, military analysts, journalists, even one UN observer who had been monitoring the elections in Jakarta when the first outbreak hit Indonesia. Everyone was an expert in his or her field. Everyone had come to their own similar conclusions before ever being contacted by us. Our report was just under 100 pages long. It was concise. It was fully comprehensive. It was everything we thought we needed to make sure this outbreak never reached epidemic proportions. I know a lot of credit has been heaped upon the South African war plan, and deservedly so. But if more people had read our report and worked to make its recommendations a reality, then that plan would have never needed to exist.
But some people did read and follow your report. Your own government.
Barely. And just look at the cost.
Bethlehem, Palestine. With his rugged good looks and polished charm, Saladin Kader could be a movie star. He is friendly but never obsequious, self-assured but never arrogant. He is a professor of urban planning at Khalil Gibran University, and, naturally, the love of all his female students. We sit under the statue of the university's namesake. Like everything else in one of the Middle East's most affluent cities, its polished bronze glitters in the sun.
I was born and raised in Kuwait City. My family was one of the few lucky ones not to be expelled after 1991, after Arafat sided with Saddam against the world. We weren't rich, but neither were we struggling. I was comfortable, even sheltered, you might say, and did it show in my actions. I watched the Al Jazeera broadcast from behind the counter at the Starbucks where I worked every day after school. It was the afternoon rush hour and the place was packed. You should have heard the uproar, the jeers and catcalls. I'm sure our noise level matched those on the floor of the General Assembly. Of course, we thought it was a Zionist lie. Who didn't? When the Israeli ambassador announced to the UN General Assembly that his country was enacting a policy of voluntary quarantine, what was I supposed to think? Was I supposed to really believe his crazy story that African rabies was actually some new plague that transformed dead bodies into bloodthirsty cannibals? How can you possibly believe that kind of foolishness, especially when it comes from your most hated enemy? I didn't even hear the second part of that fat bastard's speech, the part about offering asylum, no questions asked, to any foreign-born Jew, any foreigner of Israeli-born parents, any Palestinian living in the formerly occupied territories, and any Palestinian whose family had once lived within the borders of Israel. The last part applied to my family, refugees from the 67 war of Zionist aggression. At the heeding of the PLO leadership, we had fled our village, believing we could return as soon as our Egyptian and Syrian brothers had swept the Jews into the sea. I had never been to Israel, or what was about to be absorbed into the new state of unified Palestine.
What did you think was behind the Israeli ruse?
Here is what I thought. The Zionists have just been driven out of the occupied territories. They say they left voluntarily, just like Lebanon and most recently the Gaza Strip, but really, just like before, we knew we'd driven them out. They know that the next and final blow would destroy that illegal atrocity they call a country, and to prepare for that final blow, they're attempting to recruit both foreign Jews as cannon fodder and I thought I was so clever for figuring this part out, kidnapping as many Palestinians as they could to act as human shields. I had all the answers. Well, who doesn't at 17? My father wasn't quite convinced of my ingenious geopolitical insights. He was a janitor at Amiri Hospital. He'd been on duty the night it had its first major African rabies outbreak. He hadn't personally seen the bodies rise from their slabs or the carnage of panicked patients and security guards, but he'd witnessed enough of the aftermath to convince him that staying in Kuwait was suicidal. He'd made up his mind to leave the same day Israel made their declaration.
That must have been difficult to hear.
It was blasphemy. I tried to make him see reason, to convince him with my adolescent logic. I'd show the images from Al Jazeera, the images coming out of the new West Bank state of Palestine, the celebrations, the demonstrations. Anyone with eyes could see total liberation was at hand. The Israelis had withdrawn from all the occupied territory and were actually preparing to evacuate Al-Quds, what they call Jerusalem. All the factional fighting, the violence between our various resistance organizations, I knew that would die down once we unified for the final blow against the Jews. Couldn't my father see this? Couldn't he understand that in a few years, a few months, we would be returning to our homeland, this time as liberators, not as refugees?
How was your argument resolved?
Resolved. What a pleasant euphemism. It was resolved after the second outbreak, the larger one at Al-Jahra. My father had just quit his job, cleared out our bank account, such as it was. Our bags were packed, our e-tickets confirmed. The TV was blaring in the background, riot police storming the front entrance of a house. You couldn't see what they were shooting at inside. The official report blamed the violence on pro-Western extremists. My father and I were arguing as always. He tried to convince me of what he'd seen at the hospital, that by the time our leaders acknowledged the danger, it would be too late for any of us. I, of course, scoffed at his timid ignorance, at his willingness to abandon the struggle. What else could I expect from a man who'd spent his whole life scrubbing toilets in a country that treated our people only slightly better than its Filipino guest workers? He'd lost his perspective, his self-respect. The Zionists were offering the hollow promise of a better life, and he was jumping at it like a dog with scraps. My father tried, with all the patience he could muster, to make me see that he had no more love for Israel than the most militant Al-Aqsa martyr, but they seemed to be the only country actively preparing for the coming storm, certainly the only one that would so freely shelter and protect our family. I laughed in his face. Then I dropped the bomb. I told him that I'd already found a website for the children of Yassin and was waiting for an email from a recruiter supposedly operating right in Kuwait City. I told my father to go and be the Yahud's whore if he wanted, but the next time we'd meet was when I would be rescuing him from an internment camp. I was quite proud of those words. I thought they sounded very heroic. I glared in his face, stood from the table, and made my final pronouncement. Surely the vilest of beasts in Allah's sight are those who disbelieve. The dinner table suddenly became very silent. My mother looked down. My sisters looked at each other. All you could hear was the TV, the frantic words of the on-site reporter telling everyone to remain calm. My father was not a large man. By that time, I think I was even bigger than him. He was also not an angry man. I don't think he ever raised his voice. I saw something in his eyes, something I didn't recognize. And then, suddenly, he was on me. A lightning whirlwind that threw me up against the wall, slapped me so hard my left ear rang. "You will go!" he shouted as he grabbed my shoulders and repeatedly slammed me against the cheap drywall. "I am your father. You will obey me." His next slap sent my vision flashing white. "You will leave with this family or you will not leave this room alive." More grabbing and shoving, shouting and slapping. I didn't understand where this man had come from, this lion who'd replaced my docile, frail excuse for a parent. A lion protecting his cubs. He knew that fear was the only weapon he had left to save my life, and if I didn't fear the threat of the plague, then damn it, I was going to fear him.
Did it work?
Some martyr I turned out to be. I think I cried all the way to Cairo.
Cairo?
There were no direct flights to Israel from Kuwait, not even from Egypt, once the Arab League imposed its travel restrictions. We had to fly from Kuwait to Cairo, then take a bus across the Sinai Desert to the crossing at Taba. As we approached the border, I saw the wall for the first time. It was still unfinished, naked steel beams rising above the concrete foundation. I'd known about the infamous security fence, what citizen of the Arab world didn't, but I'd always been led to believe that it only surrounded the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Out here, in the middle of this barren desert, it only confirmed my theory that the Israelis were expecting an attack along their entire border. Good, I thought. The Egyptians have finally rediscovered their balls. At Taba, we were taken off the bus and told to walk, single file, past cages that held very large and fierce-looking dogs. We went one at a time, a border guard, this skinny black African, I didn't know there were black Jews, would hold out his hand. "Wait there," he said in barely recognizable Arabic. "Then, you go, come." The man before me was old. He had a long white beard and supported himself on a cane. As he passed the dogs, they went wild, howling and snarling, biting and charging at the confines of their cages. Instantly, two large chaps in civilian clothing were at the old man's side, speaking something in his ear and escorting him away. I could see the man was injured. His dishdasha was torn at the hip and stained with brown blood. These men were certainly no doctors, however, and the black, unmarked van they escorted him to was certainly no ambulance. Bastards, I thought, as the old man's family wailed after him, weeding out the ones too sick and old to be of any use to them. Then it was our turn to walk the gauntlet of dogs. They didn't bark at me, nor the rest of my family. I think one of them even wagged its tail as my sister held out her hand. The next man after us, however, again came the barks and growls, again came the nondescript civilians. I turned to look at him and was surprised to see a white man, American maybe, or Canadian. No, he had to be American. His English was too loud. "Come on, I'm fine," he shouted and struggled. "Come on, man, what the fuck?" He was well-dressed, a suit and tie, matching luggage that was tossed aside as he began to fight with the Israelis. "Dude, come on, get the fuck off me! I'm one of you, come on!" The buttons on his shirt ripped open, revealing a blood-stained bandage wrapped tightly around his stomach. He was still kicking and screaming as they dragged him into the back of the van. I didn't understand it. Why these people? Clearly, it wasn't just about being an Arab or even about being wounded. I saw several refugees with severe injuries pass through without molestation from the guards. They were all escorted to waiting ambulances, real ambulances, not the black vans. I knew it had something to do with the dogs. Were they screaming for rabies? That made the most sense to me, and it continued to be my theory during our internment outside Yeroham.
The resettlement camp.
Resettlement and quarantine. At that time, I just saw it as a prison. It was exactly what I'd expected to happen to us. The tents, The overcrowding, the guards, barbed wire, and the seething, baking Negev desert sun. We felt like prisoners. We were prisoners. And although I would have never had the courage to say to my father, "I told you so," he could see it clearly in my sour face. What I didn't expect was the physical examinations. Every day from an army of medical personnel. Blood, skin, hair, saliva, even urine and feces. It was exhausting, mortifying. The only thing that made it bearable, and probably what prevented an all-out riot among some of the Muslim detainees, was that most of the doctors and nurses doing the examinations were themselves Palestinian. The doctor who examined my mother and sisters was a woman, an American woman from a place called Jersey City. The man who examined us was from Jabalia in Gaza and had himself been a detainee only a few months before. He kept telling us, "You made the right decision to come here. You'll see. I know it's hard, but you'll see it was the only way." He told us it was all true, everything the Israelis had said. I still couldn't bring myself to believe him, even though a growing part of me wanted to. We stayed at Yeroham for 3 weeks until our papers were processed and our medical examinations finally cleared. You know, the whole time, they barely even glanced at our passports. My father had done all this work to make sure our official documents were in order. I don't think they even cared. Unless the Israeli Defense Force or the police wanted you for some previous unkosher activities, all that mattered was your clean bill of health. The Ministry of Social Affairs provided us with vouchers for subsidized housing, free schooling, and a job for my father at a salary that would support the entire family. This is too good to be true, I thought, as we boarded the bus for Tel Aviv. The hammer is going to fall any time now. It did once we entered the city of Beersheba. I was asleep. I didn't hear the shots or see the driver's windscreen shatter. I jerked awake as I felt the bus swerve out of control. We crashed into the side of a building. People screamed. Glass and blood were everywhere. My family was close to the emergency exit. My father kicked the door open and pushed us out into the street. There was shooting from the windows, doorways. I could see that it was soldiers versus civilians, civilians with guns or homemade bombs. This is it, I thought. My heart felt like it was going to burst. The liberation has started. Before I could do anything, run out to join my comrades in battle, someone had me by my shirt and was pulling me through the doorway of a Starbucks. I was thrown on the floor next to my family. My sisters were crying as my mother tried to crawl on top of them. My father had a bullet wound in the shoulder. An IDF soldier shoved me on the ground, keeping my face away from the window. My blood was boiling. I started looking for something I could use as a weapon, maybe a large shard of glass to ram through the Yehud's throat. Suddenly, a door at the back of the Starbucks swung open. The soldier turned in its direction and fired. A bloody corpse hit the floor right beside us. A grenade rolled out of his twitching hand. The soldier grabbed the bomb and tried to hurl it into the street. It exploded in mid-air. His body shielded us from the blast. He tumbled back over the corpse of my slain Arab brother. Only he wasn't an Arab at all. As my tears dried, I noticed that he wore payas and a yarmulke, and bloody tzitzit snaked out from his damp, shredded trousers. This man was a Jew. The armed rebels out in the street were Jews. The battle raging all around us wasn't an uprising by Palestinian insurgents, but the opening shots of the Israeli civil war.
In your opinion, what do you believe was the cause of that war?
I think there were many causes. I know the repatriation of Palestinians was unpopular. So was the general pullout from the West Bank. I'm sure the strategic Hamlet resettlement program must have inflamed more than its share of hearts. A lot of Israelis had to watch their houses bulldozed in order to make way for those fortified, self-sufficient residential compounds. Al-Quds, I believe, that was the final straw. The coalition government decided that it was the one major weak point. too large to control, and a hole that led right into the heart of Israel. They not only evacuated the city, but the entire Nablus to Hebron corridor as well. They believed that rebuilding a shorter wall along the 1967 demarcation line was the only way to ensure physical security, no matter what backlash might occur from their own religious right. I learned all this much later, you understand, as well as the fact that the only reason the IDF eventually triumphed was because the majority of the rebels came from the ranks of the ultra-Orthodox and therefore most had never served in the armed forces. Did you know that? I didn't. I realized I practically didn't know anything about these people I'd hated my entire life. Everything I thought was true went up in smoke that day, supplanted by the face of our real enemy. I was running with my family into the back of an Israeli tank when one of those unmarked vans came around the corner. A handheld rocket slammed right into its engine. The van catapulted into the air, crashed upside down, and exploded into a brilliant orange fireball. I still had a few steps to go before reaching the doors of the tank, just enough time to see the whole event unfold. Figures were climbing out of the burning wreckage, slow-moving torches whose clothes and skin were covered in burning petrol. The soldiers around us began firing at the figures. I could see little pops in their chests where the bullets were passing harmlessly through. The squad leader next to me shouted, "Borosh! Yore Borosh!" And the soldiers adjusted their aim. The figures, the creatures' heads exploded. The patrol was just burning out as they hit the ground, these charred, black, headless corpses. Suddenly I understood what my father had been trying to warn me about, what the Israelis had been trying to warn the rest of the world about. What I couldn't understand was why the rest of the world wasn't listening.
Part 2. Blame. Langley, Virginia, the United States of America.
The office of the director of the Central Intelligence Agency could belong to a business executive or doctor or an everyday small-town high school principal. There are the usual collection of reference books on the shelf, degrees and photos on the wall, and, on his desk, an autographed baseball from Cincinnati Reds catcher Johnny Bench. Bob Archer, my host, can see by my face that I was expecting something different. I suspect that is why he chose to conduct our interview here.
When you think about the CIA, you probably imagine two of our most popular and enduring myths. The first is that our mission is to search the globe for any conceivable threat to the United States, and the second is that we have the power to perform the first. This myth is a byproduct of an organization which, by its very nature, must exist and operate in secrecy.
But didn't the plague originate in China?
It did, as well as one of the greatest single maskirovkas in the history of modern espionage.
I'm sorry?
It was a deception, a fake-out. The PRC knew they were already number one surveillance target. They knew they could never hide the existence of their nationwide health and safety sweeps. They realized that the best way to mask what they were doing was to hide it in plain sight. Instead of lying about the sweeps themselves, they just lied about what they were sweeping for.
The dissident crackdown?
Bigger. The whole Taiwan Strait incident. The victory of the Taiwan National Independence Party. The assassination of the PRC defense minister. The build-up, the war threats, the demonstrations, and subsequent crackdowns were all engineered by the Ministry of State Security. And all of it was to divert the world's eye from the real danger growing within China. And it worked.
The Chinese were that good.
And we were that bad. It wasn't the agency's finest hour. We were still reeling from the purges.
You mean the reforms?
No, I mean the purges, because that's what they were. When Joe Stalin either shot or imprisoned his best military commanders, he wasn't doing half as much damage to his national security as what that administration did to us with their reforms. The last brushfire war was a debacle, and guess who took the fall? We'd been ordered to justify a political agenda. Then when that agenda became a political liability, those who'd originally given the order now stood back with the crowd and pointed the finger at us. Who told us we should go to war in the first place? Who mixed us up in all this mess? The CIA. We couldn't defend ourselves without violating national security. We had to just sit there and take it. And what was the result? Brain drain. Why stick around and be the victim of a political witch hunt when you could escape to the private sector? Fatter paycheck, decent hours, and maybe, just maybe, a little respect and appreciation by the people you work for. We lost a lot of good men and women, a lot of experience, initiative, and priceless analytical reasoning. All we were left with were the dregs, a bunch of brown-nosing myopic eunuchs.
But that couldn't have been everyone.
No, of course not. There were some of us who stayed because we actually believed in what we were doing. We weren't in this for money or working conditions, or even the occasional pat on the back. We were in this because we wanted to serve our country.
So you knew what was really happening?
No. No, I couldn't. There was no way to confirm.
But you had suspicions.
I had doubts.
Could you be more specific?
No, I'm sorry. But I can say that I broached the subject a number of times to my co-workers.
What happened?
The answer was always the same. Your funeral.
And was it?
Yep. I spoke to someone in a position of authority, just a 5-minute meeting, expressing some concerns. He thanked me for coming in and told me he'd look into it right away. The next day I received transfer orders. Buenos Aires, effective immediately.
Did you ever hear of the Warmbrun Knight report?
Sure, now, but back then. The copy that was originally hand-delivered by Paul Knight himself, the one marked Eyes Only for the director. It was found at the bottom of the desk of a clerk in the San Antonio field office of the FBI, 3 years after the Great Panic. It turned out to be academic, because right after I was transferred, Israel went public with its statement of voluntary quarantine. Suddenly, the time for advanced warning was over. The facts were out. It was now just a question of who would believe them.
Valajärvi, Finland. It is spring, hunting season. As the weather warms, and the bodies of frozen zombies begin to reanimate, elements of the UN N4, Northern Force, have arrived for their annual sweep and clear. Every year the undead's numbers dwindle. At current trends, this area is expected to be completely secure within a decade. Travis D'Ambrosia, Supreme Allied Commander Europe, is here to personally oversee operations. There is a softness to the general's voice, a sadness. Throughout our interview, he struggles to maintain eye contact.
I won't deny mistakes were made. I won't deny we could have been better prepared. I'll be the first one to admit that we let the American people down. I just want the American people to know why. What if the Israelis are right? Those were the first words out of the chairman's mouth the morning after Israel's UN declaration. I'm not saying they are. He made sure to stress that point. I'm just saying, what if? He wanted candid, not canned opinions. He was that type of man, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He kept the conversation hypothetical, indulging in the fantasy that this was just some intellectual exercise. After all, if the rest of the world wasn't ready to believe something so outrageous, why should the men and women in this room? We kept up with the charade as long as we could, speaking with a smile or punctuating with a joke. I'm not sure when the transition happened. It was so subtle, I don't think anyone even noticed. But suddenly, you had a room full of military professionals, each one with decades of combat experience and more academic training than the average civilian brain surgeon, and all of us speaking openly and honestly about the possible threat of walking corpses. It was like a dam breaking. The taboo was shattered, and the truth just started flooding out. It was liberating.
So you had your own private suspicions?
For months before the Israeli declaration, so had the chairman. Everyone in that room had heard something or suspected something.
Had any of you read the Warmbrunn Knight report?
No, none of us. I had heard the name, but had no idea about its content. I actually got my hands on a copy about 2 years after the Great Panic. Most of its military measures were almost line for line in step with our own.
Your own what?
Our proposal to the White House. We outlined a fully comprehensive program, not only to eliminate the threat within the United States, but to roll back and contain it throughout the entire world.
What happened?
The White House loved Phase One. It was cheap, fast, and, if executed properly, 100% covert. Phase One involved the insertion of special forces units into infested areas. Their orders were to investigate, isolate, and eliminate.
Eliminate?
With extreme prejudice.
Those were the Alpha teams.
Yes, sir, and they were extremely successful. Even though their battle record is sealed for the next 140 years, I can say that it remains one of the most outstanding moments in the history of America's elite warriors.
So what went wrong?
Nothing with Phase One. But the Alpha teams were only supposed to be a stopgap measure. Their mission was never to extinguish the threat, only delay it long enough to buy time for Phase Two.
But Phase Two was never completed.
Never even begun. And herein lies the reason why the American military was caught so shamefully unprepared. Phase Two required a massive national undertaking, the likes of which hadn't been seen since the darkest days of the Second World War. That kind of effort requires Herculean amounts of both national treasure and national support, both of which, by that point, were non-existent. The American people had just been through a very long and bloody conflict. They were tired. They'd had enough. Like the 1970s, the pendulum was swinging from a militant stance to a very resentful one. In totalitarian regimes, communism, fascism, religious fundamentalism, popular support is a given. You can start wars, you can prolong them, you can put anyone in uniform for any length of time without ever having to worry about the slightest political backlash. In a democracy, the polar opposite is true. Public support must be husbanded as a finite national resource. It must be spent wisely, sparingly, and with the greatest return on your investment. Americans are especially sensitive to war weariness, and nothing brings on a backlash like the perception of defeat. Now, I say perception because Americans are a very all-or-nothing society. We like the big win, the touchdown, the knockout in the first round. We like to know, and for everyone else to know, that our victory wasn't only uncontested, it was positively devastating. If not, well, look at where we were before the panic. We didn't lose the last brush fire conflict, far from it. We actually accomplished a very difficult task with very few resources and under extremely unfavorable circumstances. We won, but the public didn't see it that way because it wasn't the blitzkrieg smackdown that our national spirit demanded. Too much time had gone by, too much money had been spent, too many lives had been lost or irrevocably damaged. We'd not only squandered all our public support, we were deeply in the red. Think about just the dollar value of Phase Two. Do you know the price tag of putting just one American citizen in uniform? And I don't just mean the time that he's actively in that uniform, the training, the equipment, the food, the housing, the transport, the medical care. I'm talking about the long-term dollar value that the country, the American taxpayer, has to shell out to that person for the rest of their natural life. This is a crushing financial burden. And in those days, we barely had enough funding to maintain what we had. Even if the coffers hadn't been empty, if we'd had all the money to make all the uniforms we needed to implement Phase Two, who do you think we could have conned into filling them? This goes to the heart of America's war weariness. As if the traditional horrors weren't bad enough, the dead, the disfigured, the psychologically destroyed, now you had a whole new breed of difficulties. The betrayed. We were a volunteer army, and look what happened to our volunteers. How many stories do you remember about some soldier who had his term of service extended, or some ex-reservist who, after 10 years of civilian life, suddenly found himself recalled into active duty? How many weekend warriors lost their jobs or houses? How many came back to ruined lives, or worse, didn't even come back at all? Americans are a fair people. We expect a fair deal. I know that a lot of other cultures used to think that was naive and even childish, but it's one of our most sacred principles. To see Uncle Sam going back on his word, revoking people's private lives, revoking their freedom. After Vietnam, when I was a young platoon leader in West Germany, we'd had to institute an incentives program just to keep our soldiers from going AWOL. After this last war, no amount of incentives could fill our depleted ranks. No payment bonuses or term reductions or online recruiting tools disguised as civilian video games. This generation had had enough. And that's why, when the undead began to devour our country, we were almost too weak and vulnerable to stop them. I'm not blaming the civilian leadership. And I'm not suggesting that we in uniform should be anything but beholden to them. This is our system, and it's the best in the world. But it must be protected and defended, and it must never again be so abused.
Vostok Station, Antarctica. In pre-war times, this outpost was considered the most remote on Earth. Situated near the planet's southern geomagnetic pole, atop the 4-kilometer ice crust of Lake Vostok, temperatures here have been recorded at a world record negative 89 degrees Celsius, with the highs rarely reaching above negative 22. This extreme cold, and the fact that overland transport takes over a month to reach the station, were what made Vostok so attractive to Breckinridge, Breck Scott. We meet in the Dome, the reinforced geodesic greenhouse that draws power from the station's geothermal plant. These and many other improvements were implemented by Mr. Scott when he leased the station from the Russian government. He has not left it since the Great Panic.
Do you understand economics? I mean, big-time, pre-war, global capitalism. Do you get how it worked? I don't, and anyone who says they do is full of shit. There are no rules, no scientific absolutes. You win, you lose. It's a total crapshoot. The only rule that ever made sense to me, I learned from a history, not an economics professor at Wharton. Fear, he used to say. Fear is the most valuable commodity in the universe. That blew me away. Turn on the TV, he'd say. What do you see? People selling their products? No. People selling the fear of you having to live without their products. Fucking A, was he right? Fear of aging, fear of loneliness, fear of poverty, fear of failure. Fear is the most basic emotion we have. Fear is primal. Fear sells. That was my mantra. Fear sells. When I first heard about the outbreaks, back when it was still called African rabies, I saw the opportunity of a lifetime. I'll never forget that first report, the Cape Town outbreak. Only 10 minutes of actual reporting. Then, a full hour of speculating about what would happen if the virus ever made it to America. God bless the news. I hit speed dial 30 seconds later. I met with some of my nearest and dearest. They'd all seen the same report. I was the first one to come up with a workable pitch. A vaccine. A real vaccine for rabies. Thank God there's no cure for rabies. A cure would make people buy it only if they thought they were infected. But a vaccine? That's preventative. People will keep taking that as long as they're afraid it's out there. We had plenty of contacts in the biomed industry with plenty more up on the hill in Penn Avenue. We could have a working proto in less than a month and a proposal written up within a couple of days. By the 18th hole, it was handshakes all around.
What about the FDA?
Please, are you serious? Back then, the FDA was one of the most underfunded, mismanaged organizations in the country. I think they were still high-fiving over getting red number 2 out of M&Ms. Plus, this was one of the most business-friendly administrations in American history. J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller were getting wood from beyond the grave for this guy in the White House. His staff didn't even bother to read our cost assessment report. I think they were already looking for a magic bullet. They railroaded it through the FDA in 2 months. Remember the speech the Prez made before Congress? How it had been tested in Europe for some time, and the only thing holding it up was our own bloated bureaucracy? Remember the whole thing about people don't need big government. They need big protection. And they need it big time. Jesus Christmas, I think half the country creamed their pants at that. How high did his approval rating go that night? 60%? 70? I just know that it jacked our IPO 389% on the first day. Suck on that, Baidu.com.
And you didn't know if it would work?
Well, we knew it would work against rabies, and that's what they said it was, right? Just some weird strain of jungle rabies.
Who said that?
Well, you know, they, like, you know, the UN or the, I don't know, somebody. That's what everyone ended up calling it, right? African rabies.
Was it ever tested on an actual victim?
Why? I mean, people used to take flu shots all the time, never knowing if it was for the right strain. Why was this any different?
But the damage.
Who thought it was going to go that far? You know how many disease scares there used to be? Jesus, you'd think the Black Death was sweeping the globe every 3 months or so. Ebola, SARS, avian flu. You know how many people made money on those scares? Shit, I made my first million on useless anti-radiation pills during the dirty bomb scares.
But if someone discovered...
Discovered what? We never lied, you understand? They told us it was rabies, so we made a vaccine for rabies. We said it had been tested in Europe, and the drugs it was based on had been tested in Europe. Technically, we never lied. Technically, we never did anything wrong.
But if someone discovered that it wasn't rabies...
Who was going to blow the whistle? The medical profession? We made sure it was a prescription drug, so doctors stood just as much to lose as us. Who else? The FDA, who let it pass? The congressmen who all voted for its acceptance? The Surgeon General? The White House? This was a win-win situation. Everyone got to be heroes. Everyone got to make money. 6 months after Phalanx hit the market, you started getting all these cheaper knockoff brands, all solid sellers, as well as the other ancillary stuff like home air purifiers.
But the virus wasn't airborne.
It didn't matter. It still had the same brand name from the makers of. I mean, all I had to say was, may prevent some viral infections. That was it. I mean, now I understand why it used to be illegal to shout fire in a crowded theater. People weren't going to say, hey, I don't smell smoke. Is there really a fire? No, they say, holy shit, there's a fire. Run! You know, I've made money on home purifiers, car purifiers. My biggest seller was this little doodad you wore around your neck when you got on a plane. I don't know if it even filtered ragweed, but it sold. Things got so good, I started setting up these dummy companies, you know, with plans to build manufacturing facilities all over the country. The shares from these dumbos sold almost as much as the real stuff. It wasn't even the idea of safety anymore. It was the idea of safety. Remember when we started to get our first cases here in the States, that guy in Florida who said he'd been bitten but survived because he was taking Phalanx? Oh!
He stands, mimes the act of frantic fornication.
God freaking bless that dumbass whoever he was.
But that wasn't because of Phalanx. Your drug didn't protect people at all.
It protected them from their fears. That's all I was selling. Hell, because of Phalanx, the biomed sector started to recover, which in turn jump-started the stock market, which then gave the impression of a recovery, which then restored consumer confidence to stimulate an actual recovery. Phalanx, hands down, ended the recession. I ended the recession.
And then? When the outbreaks became more serious, and the press finally reported that there was no wonder drug?
Pre-fucking-cisely. That's the alpha cunt who should be shot. What's her name, who first broke that story? Look what she did. She pulled the fucking rug right out from under us all. She caused the spiral. She caused the great panic.
And you take no personal responsibility.
For what? For making a little fucking cash? Well, not a little. I mean, all I did was what any of us are ever supposed to do. I chased my dream, and I got my slice. You want to blame someone? Blame whoever first called it rabies, or who knew it wasn't rabies and gave us the green light anyway. Shit, you want to blame someone? Why not start with all the sheep who forked over their greenbacks without bothering to do a little responsible research? I never held a gun to their heads. They made the choice themselves. They're the bad guys, not me. I never directly hurt anybody, and if anybody was too stupid to get themselves hurt, boo fucking who. Of course, If there's a hell. Well, I don't want to think about how many of those dumb shits might be waiting for me. I just hope they don't want a refund.
Amarillo,